This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. After hours of debate about a major overhaul of Cincinnati's zoning code, City Council voted earlier this month to adopt the plan known as Connected Communities. So what happens now? Today we're going to talk about the policy changes the plan brings, how it compares to zoning code changes other cities have adopted, and what residents can expect. Joining me now are Zone co-founder and lead principal, Sean Suter. Thanks for being here, Sean.
Thank you, Lucy. Always a pleasure.
And WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter, Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hi, Lucy.
We had two programs devoted to connected communities before City Council voted on the proposal, but to refresh our memories, Nick, explain very briefly what zoning changes this plan makes.
Okay, you said very briefly, and I'm going to try. I'm going to do my best.
Do your best.
So the best way to break this down is to remind people there are 39 neighborhood business districts in the city of Cincinnati, and the plan is also is focused on those and seven transit corridors throughout the city. Most, but not all, the changes happen in those places. So the plan allows developers to build up to four units in those neighborhood business districts plus a quarter mile radius around them. So some of the single family zoning in those places would kind of be moot. Then along the bus rapid transit routes, which is two of those transit corridors within a half mile radius. There's some other places where you could build it along sort of the facing the main streets. And then you can do row homes in the sort of smallest lot size single family zoning, which is called SF2. Then there's also the subject of, so we'll get to some density stuff too. There's some density requirements that get rolled back or eliminated depending on where you are. And you can get a height bonus in some areas as well if you're a developer. So mm-hmm. those are all important things to consider. Also parking minimums. This is another big part of the plan. Citywide, no parking minimums if you're renovating an existing building. And you can reduce the parking minimums to one space per unit depending on where you are. Eliminating parking minimums along major corridors and in the neighborhood business districts, as we talked about, depending on the size of the building, smaller buildings like less than 10 units, residential, less than 5,000 square feet, no parking minimums. Above that size, it's half what it currently is.
Okay.
So that's all a lot of wonky stuff, but you kind of get the shape of what they're trying to do there, I think, with all that. Yeah.
Sure. Have more housing in these areas, whether it's, not necessarily single family housing, and lower requirements for parking. So where you used to have a parking space or maybe one and a half parking spaces, maybe for some of these smaller buildings, you wouldn't need that, hoping that people are going to ride the bus and use other means to get around.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And
okay.
So the general idea is creating more density, allowing larger buildings to be built in some areas, and, rolling back that number of parking spaces, you said.
Okay. Yeah. Sean, what's the logic behind those changes? Why did supporters of connected communities say the city needed to do this?
Housing, 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 right? We are in a housing crisis, not only in Cincinnati, but throughout the United States right now. We just don't have enough adequate housing. And part of the reason that's the case is because of zoning regulations that have made it very difficult to build density. In most communities around the United States. We work across the country, and just about every community, they limit the ability to build dense housing. We work in some communities where they might allow 4 to 6 units per acre. That's just not feasible, economically feasible. And so in Cincinnati, we have this housing crisis like we do in most places, and this is aiming at trying to allow for more residential units in places where it's context appropriate. And that would be in those areas that used to be streetcar neighborhoods. Transit-oriented development, our neighborhood business districts essentially were developed around streetcar stops. And the streetcar went away. Now they're auto-oriented, but they're still built for pedestrian activity, walkability, and mixed use. And so the zoning, however, that was put in place throughout the last, 50, 60 years, and in particular 2004, really treated it more like a suburban environment than an urban environment. So this is getting us back to the roots of many of these neighborhoods.
Yeah. Nick, would you agree with that? I know you've done some reporting on this. Sean said it's all about housing. Is that why there are so many communities around the country that are looking at zoning reform?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the main drivers. After we recovered from the Great Recession, housing supply became very limited. This is an affordability crisis we've had, over a decade in the making. The pandemic exacerbated that with the sort of runaway market for housing. So that's the main answer. I think in addition to that, though, you're seeing this reawakening of wanting to be able to walk around your city and not have to get in a car to go everywhere. So there's this sort of like walkable city movement that's happening. And there's also a lot of environmental element to it, too. You know, the more density you have, the less trips you have to take, the less you have to drive, the lower your carbon footprint. So I think cities are cognizant of all those.
Mm-hmm. Sean, you mentioned your company, Zone Co., looks at zoning all across the country. Are reforms like this mostly happening in more democratic or progressive cities and states, or is this something that's happening across the ideological spectrum?
It's a great question. That's interesting. It's actually the one of the more popular bipartisan issues of our time. There are very few things that aren't partisan today, as we all know, but this one is actually getting support from both sides of the aisle. It tends to be on the pro-housing equity side from the left of the political aisle. On the right, it tends to be more about property rights and allowing more supply. But the two parties are coming together around this issue. In fact, the Department of Housing and Urban Development just put out a big pro-housing grant yesterday, $85 million from the federal government, which is very rare for zoning reform or any kind of planning. It was issued yesterday to 21 communities, and the whole idea is to create pathways to removing obstacles to housing. So that was supported by Congress, and that's been put out. There is a bill that's moving its way through Congress now that has been put out by Senator John Fetterman. I think it's going to get some bipartisan support. It's called Removing Regulatory Barriers to Housing Bill. So this is using zoning language to say, hey, look, we've put up around all these barriers over the last 100 years, because zoning is 100 years old. It's an American experiment, if you will. And how do we break down those barriers now to allow for the sort of housing and the density of housing to start chipping away at this problem.
Yeah, and that $85 million, is anybody around here getting any of that?
The closest is Nashville Metro, okay. But no, nobody around here got it. I think every city in the country and every community applied for it, but it only went to 21. There's going to be another grant in the fall for a similar amount of money, and the John Fetterman bill would fund a new division of HUD called Planning and Zoning Agency, and it would come with it $100 million. So the federal government's starting to get involved in this, especially to kind of push states and local governments toward more housing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about what's next for Cincinnati's land use policies now that City Council has adopted the Connected Communities Plan. Do you have questions about the policy changes? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. You know, we've touched on this. So many communities are struggling with a lack of housing that people can afford. Talk a little bit more, Nick, about how proponents of zoning reforms say these reforms can help that problem.
Yeah, this is a really straightforward, I think, argument here, which is basically it's supply and demand. We don't have enough habitable housing to meet the needs of the people who need housing. So what do you have to do? You have to build more housing. I think there can be some debate about how nuanced that dynamic is, but I don't really see anybody arguing we don't need to build more housing generally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Sean? How can Connected Communities in particular, the changes within Connected Communities, how does this plan address that idea that, you know, we need more housing to make it more affordable?
You know, we work with, in my law firm side of things, we work with developers too, and a lot of them are doing infill housing in the city of Cincinnati. And there are a lot of barriers that are thrown up by the zoning code. And there are a lot of opportunities for infill as you drive around the city, whether it's an empty lot or a parking lot or something that's been torn down and now is missing teeth in the neighborhood. The developers want to build what they can build to make a project economically feasible. And that usually means more density than what the zoning code currently allows. And so this is going to help with that. This is going to allow more by right housing that will help. I won't say this is going to be tectonic shift. It's not going to solve the housing problem. But I think it's going to help to remove some of the barriers, which reduces the cost of development. The fewer hearings you have to go through and the fewer, you know, rezonings and hoops you have to jump through, the more you can put into the project and hopefully reduce the price of housing some.
It's that whole time is money kind of adage.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nick, Cincinnati's plan, Connected Communities, has been compared to what Minneapolis did. I know you reported some on this. What does the plan here have in common with what happened in Minneapolis, and where are some of the key differences?
Sure. Yeah, so I think both obviously deal with zoning and density and parking requirements. Both focus on a lot on transit areas and commercial areas, trying to incentivize more density in those places. What I think is different is the degree. So, for instance, in Minneapolis, Minneapolis started rolling back its parking requirements in 2009 and has pretty much eliminated parking requirements in the city. Cincinnati hasn't done that. You know, it's a little bit more piecemeal. Then you have the single family issue. Minneapolis allows duplexes and triplexes pretty much everywhere in the city. So that's not what Cincinnati's doing. It's much more, you know, minimal in that way. So the zoning districts are similar, but the commercial districts in Minneapolis, you can build 3 to 6 story buildings. And in the transit districts, you can build 20 to 30 story buildings. And in some of those districts, there's a height minimum. So you have to build, you know,
up to a certain height, yeah.
Not maximum. So that's a lot different than what Cincinnati's doing. So those are some of the differences. But, again, differences of degrees, the aim is pretty similar.
Yeah.
I was just... Yeah. If I may, I was just in Minneapolis for the American Planning Association conference back in April, and I rode the Blue Line from the airport downtown, and you can see it. You can see the entire Blue Line is lined with those types of apartment buildings, 4 to 6 story plus apartment buildings. It's working there.
Hmm. Talk a little bit more about that. What kind of impact have these changes had in Minneapolis when it comes to housing?
I don't know the exact numbers at this point. I'm not sure anybody has calculated it, but you can see it anecdotally on the ground. And in single family neighborhoods, there have been conversions to two families. There have been infusions of two family and three family units in otherwise single family neighborhoods. We call that incremental increases in density. You know, we're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We're not throwing out all the single family and going into huge towers, right? It's talking about adding a unit or two units, sort of getting back to the way we developed in the 1920s, which if you look at 1920s neighborhoods, and we have a number of them in our city, you might have two families mixed in with single family. You might have a four family on the corner, and then the interior of the neighborhood is all single family. It's called the missing middle. I think you've probably heard that term. And that's part of the Connected Communities justification is how do we get more missing middle? We do have zoning and we can do the towers, but we have a lot of single family zoning, but what about the 4 to 6 units? That's very hard to develop. So how do we make that possible?
Yeah. Nick, in your reporting for WVXU, what did you find in terms of impact? I mean, I think you even looked at some potential impact on homelessness, didn't you?
Yeah. So there's a couple different reports about what has happened to people experiencing homelessness and the number of people experiencing homelessness in the region and in the city. And those reports do show a decline. Depending on which report you look at it, it's a little different. But there is that. Also, in terms of rent, rent in Minneapolis, since these changes have been put in place, relatively flat, about 1% increase in recent years. And then when you look at the wider region or the state as a whole, I'm sorry, it's about 14% increase. So, it's reasonable to think that these policies had some or maybe all of, the impetus behind that. There's also the housing production side. They set some goals, the city of Minneapolis, for how many units they wanted to build. And they've met those goals pretty much every year. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will continue our conversation in just a moment, and later in the program, we'll talk about how Cincinnati officials communicate with residents about these big policy changes. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about what's next with Cincinnati's land use policies now that City Council has adopted the Connected Communities Zoning Code overhaul. My guests are Zone co-founder and lead principal Sean Suter and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sean, we talked before the break about some of the impact that you think Connected Communities is going to have when it comes to housing production, affordability. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that and just how long you think it'll take to start seeing that.
Well, these are long-term fixes to long-term problems, right? So, unfortunately, it does take a while to see the impacts and the results of a zoning change. But I think you'll start seeing it right away. It won't be, you know, that noticeable. I think over time, over the next development cycle of maybe 3 to 5 years, you'll start actually seeing it on the ground. What we'll see now is more applications to the city for development with more units that are context appropriate in the locations where they're allowed, and more by right. And so actually, you might see a little less drama around some of these developments because they won't need as many hearings, if any, to do the kind of development that the market's demanding.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, and at the risk of throwing a curveball at you, which I don't mean to do, but our friend Chris Wetterich, a reporter at the Business Courier, I know he did some reporting leading up to the Connected Communities vote, talked to some developers who've been developing duplexes, I think primarily duplexes, and the selling price for those duplexes, I think, was an average of $300,000, $400,000, not what most of us would consider super affordable for people in that middle housing kind of space we're talking about. Some of the developers he talked to said, we don't know how we can do it for a whole lot cheaper. How tricky is it going to be, especially with these duplexes, with these triplexes, to develop housing that is, you know, $125,000, something that more people consider affordable for purchase?
It's going to be very challenging. There are still some things that are held constant even throughout the country, and that are among those construction costs, the cost of material, the cost of labor. That doesn't change a ton throughout the country. So the cost per square foot of building new construction is going to be $200, $300 a square foot, no matter how you slice it. And the land costs, especially in an urban area, can be higher, including removing maybe existing improvements or building within a very tight, dense environment can cost more. One nice thing is there are already utilities there, which will be helpful. But I think it's going to be very hard to build affordable housing. What it's trying to do is add supply, and the idea is if with more supply, that will help with the cost. But the fact is that building infill, building missing middle housing is expensive.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller on the line, Tim, who raised some questions that I think this was something that we heard during these public hearings for Connected Communities. His concern was that he thinks this could lead to increased development in neighborhoods that could potentially increase property taxes, property values, and potentially price lower income people out of their neighborhoods. What do you think about that, Sean? Is that a myth? Is that something, I mean, people are so concerned about property taxes right now. What's your view when you take a look at this plan?
Yeah, the reality is that the development's going to take place where there's demand. That's the way it is. And so those neighborhoods that people consider maybe more desirable to move to, walkable neighborhoods with amenities, restaurants, shops, that kind of thing, those are going to be the first places that develop. And those aren't going to be affordable generally on a mass scale. The hope is that there's a way that this will allow for more communities to participate in the development and redevelopment of their neighborhoods by reducing the cost of development, the regulatory risk of the development. So out of a $1 that you spend, how much of that is getting through the city processes? Can we reduce that amount to make it more feasible to invest in neighborhoods that may not otherwise see that investment?
Mm. Nick, Connected Communities doesn't have affordable housing requirements. Does that mean inclusive zoning is not part of Connected Communities? Help us understand that piece of the puzzle.
So generally, when people use that term inclusionary zoning, they are talking about some kind of requirement that developers build. A portion of their housing should be affordable. So if you build 10-unit building, 20-unit building, one or two of those units, whatever, should be affordable. The council members who have supported connected communities as I passed it and the mayor have said they don't think that's the right approach for Cincinnati. And their argument is, well, we're trying to incentivize developers to build, and then we're going to make this kind of like requirement that might be a disincentive, and we need as much housing as we can get. Now, other folks, including some members of council and the Cincinnati NAACP, for example, and some other organizations say, no, we need affordable housing requirement. Otherwise, the market's not going to create this housing at the really low income level. But the plan as it was passed does not include that. Some other cities, Minneapolis being the major example, have included inclusionary zoning, but there's a lot of options for developers within that, including saying like, hey, you know, you can't make it pencil out to build affordable units. Put some money in a basically affordable housing trust. Mm-hmm. And those policies have created about 500 units of affordable housing over the past 5 years. And there's, no, not 5 years, the past few years. I won't say five for sure. And there's about another 500 in the pipeline. So just to give you an idea of like how much that's created.
Yeah. Sean, do you think Cincinnati will see more affordable housing built even without that requirement? And I know there are lots of different ways to define affordable housing. I mean, it's 30% of your income is kind of the definition, but for very low income people, those need to be very low rents or very low sales prices. Do you think we're going to see more of that because of connected communities, even without that requirement?
I'm not sure. We're seeing affordable housing being built at the higher income levels of affordability. So 50, 60, 70% AMI. And that's where I think it pencils out. Any lower than that, it's going to have to be subsidized. And so I don't think Cincinnati is the kind of market that can require you to include affordable housing from an economic standpoint. I think it's more of a market where we're going to have to continue to incentivize it.
Mm. Sean, what are you watching for next with how these changes roll out across the city?
Looking to see if it spurs more applications. I would love to know if developers feel like this is giving them more of a green light to go in and do some projects that they might not otherwise do. I'd also like to see some statistics from the city about where development is occurring, maybe where in neighborhoods where it otherwise wouldn't have based on this connected communities. Definitely, I think some data over the next several years will be important to give a review of whether this legislation was effective or not.
Yeah. Well, and I want to make sure we get specific about what kind of data you think will really paint that picture, because that was something that came up a lot during these conversations and meetings and the public feedback, too. A lot of different people want to look at a lot of different data points to see what the impact of this is.
Yes. Price data, unit count and inventory data. Maybe data, it may also be some anecdotal evidence from realtors and other folks too. But I think there, this is something, you know, we have a start date and we can put a end date on the data discovery, and we can compare. Has this led to more units? We can look at particular projects and see did this pencil out better for the developer to just reduce the price of the housing for the consumer? I think we'll be able to do a detailed review.
Yeah. Well, and Sean, we started out talking about how there's so much zoning reform being talked about all around the country. Places like Minneapolis have done things a little differently, have gone a little bit farther in some areas than what Connected Communities does. Do you think this could lead to more zoning reform in the years to come as we start to see the impact of connected communities? Could this plan be tweaked or changed,
Absolutely.
In years ahead?
Yeah. I mean, right now we're piecemeal updating the zoning code. The base zoning code in Cincinnati goes back to 2004. In 2013, we added a form-based section of the zoning code. And this changes some elements of the zoning code, but we're piecemeal updating what is now a 20-year-old zoning code. What's going to have to happen, and I think what might happen, is the comprehensive plan is now a decade old. I think it's a good time, and I think there's some political will to revisit the comp plan and to update that over the next several years, and that will hopefully lead to a complete overhaul of the zoning code based on that plan and implementing that plan.
Okay. More zoning conversations potentially in the future. I've been talking with Zone co-founder and lead principal Sean Suter and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll talk about how Cincinnati officials communicate with residents about these big policy changes. This is Cincinnati Edition.